At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. This is going to be episode 64, Interview with Randy Oliver, part two. We had too much fun the first time around, so we had to split it up into two different segments. But before we get to that, if you would, please check us out over on YouTube. We're doing a beekeeping tip of the day every day for the month of September. We might continue it longer if it seems like something that everybody is enjoying. If you like it, comment, let us know. If you don't like it, comment and let me know what we can do better. But I'm really trying to kind of grow the presence there. I mentioned this in the Bee Buzz the other day. I kind of screwed up a little bit. I put a little bit too much energy and emphasis on that side of things, and I neglected my podcast people a little bit, and I feel bad about that. So I'm trying to kind of shift the focus back over here to pay more attention to all of you because I miss you, and you're so kind and friendly and lovely and all kinds of great stuff. So my apologies for not giving you the attention you deserve recently, but I am trying to find ways to balance it out and try to get things to where they should be. I still recognize tremendous value in the ability to talk about something and then show a video of it. So as I finally am getting things ready and got the software and the hardware and the stuff I need to do, you know, live streams and other fun things and enough tripods to have stuff, I'm laughing because like, I'm like, oh, I'll just put that on this tripod from 20 years ago and my cameras are falling on the ground and weird things are happening. But I'm working on it, folks. I'm trying. Okay, so I'm not going to tie you up much more with me just running my mouth here. We're going to jump right into this second half of our interview with Randy Oliver. So there is something that you do that not a lot of other beekeepers do out there. And I've seen, you know, a lot of videos of you doing this. So you have no gear on while doing inspections, which I absolutely love because when I first started out, I was covered head to toe, and I mean, I'd lose 5 pounds of water during inspections and just be lightheaded. I mean, it was a disaster. And as I progressed through the years, I started peeling things off, and I got to a point where, you know, veil and no gloves, you know, I usually protect the face pretty much all the time. I still can't let go of that. But how would you recommend, you know, the process of progressing from, you know, being covered head to toe to going, you know, gearless like you do? And a little add-on bonus question with that is there a race of bees you recommend that is more in line with that calmer temperament?
Okay. Well, this is interesting because I teach beginner classes every spring in various towns. And the beginners show up, you know, dressed head to toe and, you know, duct tape and boots and all this type of stuff. If they come back for a second class, often even during the first class, they shed all that stuff. And now the beginners come, you know, who have been once or twice, you know, they come over and they're just dressed in shorts and t-shirts and nobody in the group has the veil. I went out last weekend. I did an all-day beginners class down in the Bay Area for 30 people and an all-day class at home with about that many people. Worked for many hours out in the bee yard, expecting multiple hives, and that there was not a single sting to anybody in either group, except for one sting I got in the finger when I pressed my finger onto a bee inadvertently on a comb. There were no stings whatsoever. And that spoils you because we're keeping very gentle bees. Now, many beekeepers, that would be foolish to go into a hive that way because you're going to get stung up in the eye. So it really depends a whole lot on the stock you keep. And there are beekeepers who breed for very, very gentle stock. That's our number one priority. We have a zero tolerance policy for any colony that is stingy at all. So we can get by with that. We will generally put a veil on if we're working during the winter or it's raining or snowing or something like that when the bees are it's getting near dark when the bees are more defensive. But during the day, we prefer to work without that gear. So the steps are, first, never use leather gloves. They're just, you get clumsy, you can learn all kinds of bad habits. If you want gloves on, use white 5-mil nitrile gloves. That lets you feel bees under your finger and will prevent most all the stings. It allows you to start handling. As you slowly build up immunity to bee stings, then you can start discarding those gloves. And it depends upon how much you react to the stings. You want to get stung on a regular basis in order to develop immunity rather than sensitizing yourself towards allergy. So the occasional sting tends to sensitize you to allergy. The getting stung on a regular basis desensitizes you in general. Eventually you get to the point where you no longer itch and swell up from a bee sting. At that point, then it's up to you whether you want to stop wearing a veil or not. The problem is the sting on the eyelid. A sting on the eyelid, if you don't scrape it out quickly, the stinger can actually penetrate the eyelid and scrape your cornea. That's a very rare occurrence. It's only happened to me once in my entire beekeeping career, but that's the possibility. So once you get immunity to these things, even your eye doesn't swell up. You don't like getting stung in the eye or the nose because they're very painful, the nerves there. But once you when you get to the point where you're not going to be swelling up, then you can start working without a veil. So, the main thing is this: you're going to be a beekeeper. Honeybees have stingers and they use them. So get over it. Accept that. So you can either be an adversary to your bees and gird up for battle every time and have a lot of fear. Or what I do is when I do my hands-on, the main thing I do is just demonstrate to people how to work cooperatively with your bees. So you do not engender any defensive reaction. If you learn how not to get the bees to feel defensive, they don't sting you. And it's just, so I can work side by side in the same yard with another beekeeper, and that person will be getting stung on every single hive, and I'll be getting zero stings on every hive. And they go, why is that? And I say, well, you want me to tell you? I'll start hollering out every time I see a twitch, every time I see a fast movement, every time I hear a bang or a bump or something like that. And I do that, they go, oh my gosh, yes, I had no idea I was being so rough and giving these signals to the honeybees. You learn how to move smoothly, learn how not to jar the hive, not to pop things in there. And the bees will tolerate tremendous amount of handling. Everybody in my beginner classes gets a whole double handful of bees scooped up and placed into their open hands just to feel what it's like to have a bunch of bees in your hands that have no inclination for stinging. And that's a transformation in every class. Once the first person does that, and then pretty soon all the hands are out, and at that point, everybody goes, wow. And the gloves disappear. Many of the veils disappear. People go, wow, I had no idea that you could work bees on a cooperative manner rather than an adversarial manner with fear. Once you dispense with your fear, you move differently, and the bees do not respond to you. It's being afraid of the bees that gives you all those little jerky movements that the bees interpret as somebody attacking them.
See, I just figured you went and said, well, as Sensei Oliver, I'm in tune with my bees and they know, they can feel my energy, maybe go with that approach.
that's a really beautiful way to say it. But what I see is I can see out of the corner of my eye and hear with my ears the things that are pissing off the bees. Yeah, I shouldn't say pissing off. You can't piss off a bee. That's a human trait. Don't anthropomorphize. The things that are initiating defensive response. And it's pretty simple. The bees, you can say it's energy or the vibe, whatever, but I can see it just visually. So I can have a computer pick up if it was with AI watching you whether you're going to get stung or not. And that's not a vibe. That's just simple mechanics of how you move and the jolts that you make.
No, that's neat. You know, it's funny you mentioned, as you were talking, you said, I recommend, you know, the white nitrile gloves, 5 mil. And as you were saying that, it immediately reminded me of a guy in our Discord room the other day. And he says, hey, gosh, I really love using those new gloves that you guys recommended. I did get stung once. And as soon as he said that, I said, hey, by the way, what color were those? He goes, oh, they were black. And I said, hey, just out of curiosity, what color hands does a black bear have? You know? Yes. So I said, tone down the color a little bit if you can. So
yeah, they're white. And I like to get the 12-inch cuffs that go. So if you have a bead jacket on, the cuff goes over the gloves. And that keeps you from having your wrist skin exposed. But we use those, you know, for working in the wintertime, which we do, or working in the rain, which we often do also.
Sure, sure. So I've got a question.
All right, next question.
Yeah. I've got one on the list here, and it was something that you said, and I just took a quick note about because I wanted to kind of learn a little bit more. But you mentioned in the video about rust fungus, and you said that, and I think it was, if I remember correctly, I thought you said blackberry pollen in September or October, and you said
blackberry
add pollen.
Yeah,
and you said add pollen substitute within 2 days, you'll have fresh larvae, and you're back in business. That's my notes, so I don't know if that's cryptic or if that all makes sense to you.
No, that makes complete sense. And that's what's happening right now in California. We have an invasive blackberry, Himalaya blackberry, that's very widespread. And in recent years, we've picked up three different species of blackberry rust fungi. And what they do is you'll see the bottom of some of the blackberry leaves turn bright fluorescent orange, like somebody sprayed painted them bright fluorescent orange. That color, the rust fungus has evolved to come up with a color that fluoresces under ultraviolet light so that the bees see ultraviolet. So it looks very bright to the bees. And it causes the blackberry plant to secrete a sugary solution around the spores of the fungus. And the bees then gather that sugary solution and those spores. And the bees can't tell that those spores are not pollen grains. So they are. It tricks the foragers into thinking those spores are pollen grains. They are not pollen grains, and they are not good nutrition for the honeybee. But these foragers, when you start seeing your foragers coming back with this fluorescent orange, now not just plain orange, but fluorescent orange pollen, and then you see combs with a band of bee bread around the combs that is fluorescent orange. If you look under the microscope, you'll see that they don't look like pollen grains. They look like fried eggs instead. And that was a huge question back when CCD was first happening. And I started analyzing with a microscope the guts of the bees. And my friend, Dr. Eric Musson at UC Davis, who is an expert on Noxzema, and we're looking at samples of colonies that were going downhill in the fall. He goes, what are these fried eggs in here? And I said, you don't know? And I said, no, I don't know what it is. It took some research, finally me actually posting worldwide for ideas, and a researcher in Europe posted back, look up Euromyces, which is the genus of rust fungus. And I saw searches or images of their spores, and they go, bingo, we nailed it. And it's blackberry rust fungus spores, which have a toxicity to the bees and to the jellyfish and the larvae. So you can see a comb surrounded by this beautiful fluorescent orange bee bread, and you see larvae dying in the cells. And that's telling you there's something wrong with that picture.
Oh, well, now, so
that solved a huge problem for us. We were having colonies that were dwindling in the fall, despite having all this bee bread and us feeding sugars there. We could not figure out what the problem was. Once I realized what that problem was, I thought, oh, my God, it's rust fungus toxicity to the hive. And if you give them an alternative protein source, pollen patties, they will ignore that rust fungus bee bread and start eating the pollen patties, and within a couple of days, you see the amount of jelly that they're feeding to the larvae increases greatly, and the colonies then can rear a healthy brood for going into winter.
So do you have to scrape that out manually, or do they just discard it on their own? How do you get rid of that?
We just leave it in there, and I really don't know what they do with it, but it eventually disappears.
Wow.
But by feeding the supplemental pollen sub, that turns the colonies around. Now, I don't know if other areas you have blackberry rust fungus, but here in California, or Northern California, that's an absolute yes.
Wow, now that's interesting. Okay. When I was little, my grandmother had bird feeders and a bird bath in her backyard. Some of my favorite memories growing up were listening to her tell me everything she knew about the feathered friends that visited her yard daily. How amazing would it have been for us to be able to capture images and videos of that experience and to be able to share them with others? Well, if you're ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level, FeatherSnap makes Wi-Fi enabled smart bird feeders that blend the best of technology and nature. Get a high def glimpse of your feathered friends with a top of the line camera so every visitor can be seen with clarity and detail. A unique dual feeder bin helps attract more species, and built-in solar panels keep your camera's battery going strong. FeatherSnap's mobile app creates a truly immersive experience, allowing you to collect and organize your favorite pics and videos and earn badges along the way. Best of all, FeatherSnap offers expert-trained AI identification of more than 275 North American species thanks to their in-house ornithologist. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com. As most of you know, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, and most of my time is dedicated to beekeeping and gardening-related discussions. But you probably did not know that one of my responsibilities as a kid was caring for our houseplants. Yes, part of my $5 a week allowance went towards making sure all of the houseplants were healthy and happy. We used to have shamrocks, Christmas cactus, philodendron, and more. Which leads us to today's podcast sponsor, and a special thanks to Palm Street. Palm Street is the best live shopping app for the plant lover community. You can buy and sell rare plants, crystals, ceramics, and other unique goods. Connect with trusted plant sellers and nurseries that sell nationwide. Shop 24/7 and with live human customer support. What I love most about Palm Street is joining a live stream where sellers walk through all the details and characteristics of the plants they're offering. You can get live answers to your questions and see what questions others have asked as well. It's such a great way to engage for buyers and sellers. And as a special offer, new users will receive $5 app credit, 10% off their first order, and up to $6 off shipping for 3 orders. Palm Street, available on Google Play or the App Store.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
The next one I have here, I've got a note about, I think you were during your discussion, you were talking about, you know, GMO crops and neonicotinoids. And you mentioned, well, there's this place here in Indiana and they've got these supers that were stacked, you know, overhead high. And you were going through that discussion. I don't remember all the details of it, but you probably do.
Yeah. During the neonic discussion, I said, oh my God, here it is. This is just like tobacco industry all over again, with the industry selling something that's toxic, that has this huge environmental effects. And there was a fresh book coming out saying this would be the end of insects and humanity because of the neonic insecticides having this residual cumulative action. And then Kim Flott, an editor of Bee Culture Magazine, asked me to review the book. And I started doing that. And I got into a long correspondence with the author. And the first thing I said is, hang on, neonicotinoids have the same action as nicotine on the sodium-gated nicotinic receptors of the sodium ion channels. If they had cumulative action, every smoker would be dead because the nicotine you get from every cigarette would accumulate and die. That doesn't happen. What makes you think it's going to happen to neonicotinoids? And he was unable to answer that question. He wrote the whole book on it based upon the premise that was going to happen, but he had no evidence whatsoever. So I talked to some of the researchers who had helped, not university research, not chemical researchers, not pesticide company researchers, about that. And they said, oh, no, there's no cumulative action. And then Souchel from France came out with a paper that was widely, widely, widely cited about the neonics, saying that minute doses could kill the bees. But she also published another paper where she tracked the carbon-14, radioactive carbon, what happens to neonicotinoids when they go within the bee's body. Within 4 hours, the bees completely detoxify them. They're gone. There's no cumulative action of them. So I am not a proponent of pesticides. I've been an organic gardener forever. But I realized, wow, something is wrong with this picture of blaming everything on the neonics. So I started actually investigating it and got in tight with the head ecotoxicologist at Bayer Chemical Company. I found out he was very much an environmentalist and would answer my questions, not as a salesperson, but reality-wise. And found out, yeah, the neonicotinoids were being widely overused. The planting dust was an issue at that time. But within a few years, the farmers figured out how not to make the planting dust much of an issue. So when I said, well, then let me go out to ground zero and of neonicotinoid use in the world. And I checked to see where the most intensive application of neonicotinoids were on the entire planet Earth. That was Indiana. So I went out to visit beekeepers there. And they said, well, yeah, good time for a reality check. This is the best it's ever been for beekeeping in our memories. After the pesticide kills that we got back in the 60s and 70s, it's much, much, much better now. The bees are so much healthier now than they were. So that really made me start questioning things. And then I read the book, Seeds of Deception. It scares the hell out of you about, you know, GMOs or genetically engineered crops. And I did further research and found out, oh, no, now that's also just a bunch of nonsense, too. This selective breeding is a huge advance in plant breeding. And as they're very much tested crops. So people conflate the two of them. So most genetically engineered crops have nothing to do with pesticides. They're due to help with drought resistance or disease resistance or more nutritious plants or plants that plant grow faster or have better flavor or color. It has nothing to do with pesticides at all. Everything, every organism on Earth is genetically modified due to viruses. Passing genes around, human beings, every human is a genetically modified organism. So the reality check is, yeah, there is progress in plant breeding, and genetic engineering is definitely progress and fits into the system. And I'm, as being a lifelong organic gardener, I resent that the organic community has rejected that because it was originally developed specifically for the organic farming community. To be able to get away from pesticides and synthetic fertilizers and have more healthful crops. So I wound up stepping on a lot of toes. I wound up getting death threats and stuff. But when I do PowerPoints to groups in very anti-GMO locations, I do a whole hour PowerPoint on understanding GMOs. I'll have half the people in the audience walk up to me afterwards and shake my hand and say, thank you, that I was misunderstanding.
Wow.
Similarly, with looking at the neonicotinoids, so I am not a pesticide proponent in any way. I will be the first to say that neonicotinoids are widely overused. I'll be the first to say I don't think that homeowners should be able to buy the bulk, the Bayer Big treatments for soaking treatments with the neonicotinoids to pour over the roots of trees and plants. That I think that's stupid. That I think you should have a license to have to do that. But we're not seeing that neonicotinoids are the big problem that they were made out to be. I'm also an aquatic biologist. I'm more concerned with what's happening with aquatic species with pesticides. But, you know, the pesticide runoff from agriculture is really tough on aquatic species. But I would not single out the neonicotinoids. And they've replaced much more dangerous pesticides. But now, as insects are developing resistance to them, the next year we have new generations of them. And what we really need to do is to shift to integrated pest management in our agricultural systems and move away towards the biopesticides and the other naturally rapidly degrading pesticides, which is why I'm trying to push the EPA to look at the biopesticides for rural control, the thymol, oxalic acid, and formic acid as biopesticides. They're natural ingredients made in nature. They get degraded very quickly, much safer. And I'm surprised that the EPA is not helping us more by allowing us more free use of those with a use exemption or adding them to the minimal risk list, which is what I would like them to do. So let's see, now back to your original question. Oh, so during the big neonicotinoid debate, which was really a hot debate among beekeepers. I'd have beekeepers from various areas. One of them, I use a picture from up in Ontario, Canada, where his bees make a crop of honey on the genetically engineered soybeans with genetically engineered canola with neonicotinoid seed treatment, and he's got these stacks of boxes stacked as high as you can reach, these huge yards making, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of honey per hive. And he goes, man, if this is what GMO and neonicotinoids do, give me more of this. And does it year after year with very, very healthy bees. So these are the kind of things that it's easy to some of the environmental groups, to which I am a member of many, but boy, I've written to them saying, you know what? I expect better of you than by using fear-mongering with no evidence to raise money and demonizing companies that are actually trying to come up with better treatments than what was out there. I lose respect for the environment group for doing that. And I noticed that Sierra Club, after I don't know how much my complaints had to do with it, they stopped using that the fundraising letter saying, oh yeah, you know, Bayer Chemical and the neonicotinoids are, you know, killing off all the insects. Insects are having a hard time worldwide on the earth, but it's not related to insecticides. There's other things happening. I'm guessing it's mainly due to climate change and higher carbon dioxide levels, which affect plant nutrition. I know there may be other things, but there isn't a correlation with the use of pesticides and the disappearance of insects.
You know, there's a lot that you said that in my mind, as you're talking, I'm making notes and I'm thinking like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense. But I think that what you hit home with, at least to me here, is a lot of times people want to, like, I'm a bit of, I don't want to say reclusive, but I keep to myself. I mind my own business. And there are a lot of people that I think like to just, I don't want to say live in isolation, but they like to just go do their thing. They don't want to be involved with a lot of other people. And I think that when you do that in the bee space, in the, you know, as a beekeeper, you're really missing out on a lot. And I think that having that regular, I mean, you just made a great example of that, just that portion of this discussion. There's a lot there that I really hadn't thought of, wasn't aware of. It's definitely a learning opportunity, but it's having that continuous and regular dialogue, you know, within the community and with other beekeepers and exchanging ideas and thoughts. And even equally as important to me is that receptiveness to the ideas of others to say, hey, you know, this is what I think. Give me your opinion. Give me your opposing view, whatever it
Absolutely.
Might be. And let's have that dialogue. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I live, you mentioned, you know, the aquatic, some of the aquatic aspects of things and your experience there. I live on a river, and that's something that I just go absolutely nuts on, because I'm the guy in the neighborhood who, like, everybody has the, you know, the grass companies come out, they spray all the stuff. Everybody's yard is beautiful and green and has no weeds. My yard, I don't cut it for about a good month or so in the spring, so it's almost a foot high. I've got flowers everywhere, that are like natural wildflowers, and I have, you know, clover, and I love my dandelions, and like nobody likes me, but I tell them, I'm like, you guys look out back, like we live on a river, and I said every piece of junk you put in here, it rolls right out of your yard
into that river.
And I learned that lesson 1 year. I rented a house. We were there for 5 years. It's about a half mile down the road, and it had a swimming pool in it. And 1 year I was like, hey, you know, I'm going to try and put some of this stuff in the grass and see if I can make the grass greener. And it completely destroyed the pool. And there wasn't even that much there. I can't remember off the top of my head what I had done, but whatever was in the chemical, basically chlorine would no longer bind to anything, and it was you had a chlorine level that was through the roof, but no algae would be killed, and it was nitrates. That's what it was, nitrates in the pool. So I thought, if this is what I did with just a little bit of fertilizer in the yard, what in the world is going on in this river behind here?
Oh yeah,
so yeah,
a lot, and I clear out into the ocean. So humans have huge environmental impact, but the thing is, people want something simple to blame, and it's not that. And the blaming is not just going to be from genetically engineered crops or pesticides. It's more fundamental in our lifestyles and all the other junk we put into the environment and our impact.
Absolutely.
Okay, I got time for one more question, then I got to get back to work.
Oh, let's see here. Let's see the best one on here. Let me just, I've only got six here. Let me see if I can find which one is the best one to go. Actually, there's not even that many, because the last ones are just my end of notes. Okay, so I'll go to what I think is a good one here. I am a proponent of hive ventilation in the wintertime. I have what I call a vented inner cover, and it has a piece of insulation up there, lets some air come up, and it really, what it helps is kind of reduce some of the condensation. And I've heard people say different things. Oh, you got to keep it completely sealed up because you want them to keep all that heat in. And I always say, no. You've got to have some cool air coming in to offset that condensation. So can you solve the debate for us? What do you think about that?
Well, I never say what I think. I'll say what I have hard evidence on. Okay.
All right.
What people think means no difference to me. I'm interested in the idea, but it doesn't mean it has any necessary evidence backing up what they think. It's just words.
Fair enough.
Okay. So E.F. Phillips, way back with the Beekeeper of Warlow, has a great quote published in 1920 saying, "Beekeepers learn soon that honeybees want one entrance in a hive, and they will do, no matter what the beekeeper does, they're going to make the attempt to seal up the other entrances." So what is it about humans that think that they know better than millions of years of evolution of the honeybees? So that got me going thinking about that. Like, clear back then, people had already noticed that the bees want to close the entrance down. They typically, if you don't breed for bees that do not produce propolis, they will put a propolis means pro in front of, olus means the city. So propolis means the front of the city. That's the wall that the honeybees build in front of the hive to close off the entrance during the winter. They want just a very few tiny ventilation holes in one place. Now, then one of the things to think about is the analogy of, how about you lived in a two-story house, and during winter, how would you want to open the front door and open the top upper window and live in that house? And you go, people go, oh God, no, you know, you freeze to death because you have this thermosiphoning of the air coming in as it warmed up inside the house, out the ups, and the cold air coming in. That would be contrary to what the colony would want. So I was curious about that, thinking, when I look at the data, hard data, it doesn't seem to make much difference as far as colony survival or consumption of stores, whether or not you put top ventilation on. So I ran an experiment last year, and I'm going to be following up on this much more coming up soon, of setting up two identical hives with no bees and putting in a heater into a gallon paint can, putting aquarium heaters in there. So I could put them, heat them up to the identical temperature, side-by-side hives. The only difference is in one hive, I could flip a coin and unplug a top vent and leave the bottom open. So I did that, and thinking that, well, I turn off the heater, unplug the heater when I start, and then the amount of heat that is lost from that hive through that top ventilation would show, because that can of hot water will cool at a lower rate. And you could calculate because if you know the mass of the water and you know how many degrees it drops, that tells you how many calories per minute are lost. It's a very easy calculation to make. I was expecting that the one with the top vent would lose calories at a much higher rate than the one that did not have a top vent. But I was completely wrong. It didn't happen. There wasn't much difference. And what I realized was, people aren't, when you use that analogy of the house with the window open at the top and the door open at the bottom, you're not taking into account the friction of all the combs inside the hive. When I look at, do the calculation for the difference in density of the outside air versus the inside air as it heats up, there's almost, it's not like a wood stove where you have that flue of a wood stove works because of the huge temperature difference between the air inside the chimney and the air in the room. So you get a very strong thermosiphoning that makes all your smoke go out the top of the chimney. That doesn't happen in a beehive. There's almost no thermosiphoning that actually takes place there. So that helped to answer the question to me about why you can do top ventilation and does not have such a negative impact on the bees as far as needing winter stores or chilling. So that's question one. Question two is ventilation. Not ventilation, but loss of moisture at the top. So I asked a bunch of beekeepers in very cold winter areas that if there is indeed moisture coming out of that top vent, that you would see ice crystals forming immediately at the mouth of that vent, because they would condense immediately hitting that cold air. And I tried it, and I weighed some of those crystals where I saw that, and there's almost no weight to them. So I asked others to do the same, and they're saying, you know what? You know, we're saying that you lose a lot of moisture at the top end, but we don't see hardly any ice, not enough to make any appreciable value up there. So that makes me question as far as how much that helps. Research from Tomema out of Estonia, where they used insulated hives, and he put in aluminum sheets and collected the water that's actually condensed, said with an insulated cover, you get almost no condensation at all at the top of the hive. It's all over on the sides of the hive, which actually is a benefit to the bees, because a colony during winter, a strong colony, their problem is they get too thirsty. A weak colony has too much moisture because it doesn't get lost. So a strong colony needs that condensing water on those outer surfaces in order to at least go lick it up and use it so they don't get thirsty. So far, my assessment of this is that the main problem with condensation is that you're using too large a colony relative to your cluster size. That if you have a weak colony in the box, you're going to have moisture problems. If you have a strong colony in that box with an insulated lid, you probably are not going to have moisture problems. Anyway, I'm going to be following up with testing this winter, addressing that thing, because the research has been confusing, the research findings on this whole question of top ventilation or not, or benefit. So there was also another beekeeper sent me as a master's beekeeper program experiment where he put in a heater in the hive and then had top ventilation or top ventilation and added so many milliliters of water every day to the heater to simulate moisture being lost from the beehive. And he said he had honey in these hives, no bees. And he said there was more moisture absorbed in the honey by the ones without top ventilation. So that was a possible benefit of top ventilation of moisture. So anyway, I want to investigate this more deeply myself. So in answer to your simple question, it's a very complex answer. But the simple summary of, we still don't know. Despite tons of research being done over the last 100 or so years, anybody who says they can answer that question is talking out of their ass. Because we're just not understanding it fully. But we can go back to what the bees tell you, is they want one vent, and for them to be able to manage and regulate it themselves. The best I'm seeing to this point is the relationship between cluster size and colony and hive volume. A small colony, small cluster in a large cavity will probably have moisture issues. A large cluster, based upon work by Jeffries in Scotland, indicates that there's a maximum cluster size you can have because the bees get too hot and too thirsty during the winter, and they die of thirst. So around that 10 combs covered with bees appears to be optimal cluster size, 9 or 10 combs covered with bees for the European honeybee, and not over generally a two-story hive, or if you're up in Canada, a three-story hive with the cluster being at the very bottom to start with, and possibly a midway opening might be a benefit for winter flight, for cleansing flights. So that's the best I can tell you for an answer right now.
Sure. No, that all makes sense. And, you know, the one that I particularly use, it actually has 2.5 inches of foam insulation at the top. So that's the only, there's no real vent. The hole is about the size of like what you would see in an inner cover. It's about that big, but that's covered by 2.5 inches of insulation. And what I found with it is it seems like the moisture is kind of, I think you can almost get the best of both worlds, because that upper condensation that might form kind of gets absorbed into that insulation. But yet you can still have the,
Hang on.
Yes.
When you say absorb into insulation, what kind of insulation are you using?
It's just a 2.5 inch foam insulation.
No water goes into foam insulation. It does not get absorbed.
It seems to, how do you describe it?
Please stop using the word seems. What do you actually observe?
Well, I don't open it till the spring. So
when beekeepers use the word seems, that's a huge qualifier.
Well, I would say by comparison, if I take my inner cover off without it, it's really heavy because it's saturated with a lot of water. And in the absence of that and using this in its place, I don't have that. So my assumption, and again, yeah,
saying is using, you have an inner cover underneath the insulation.
No, it's basically top deep, and then this inner cover sits on it. It's about 2.5 inches high. It's a little bit of a tray almost, and the insulation sits, this foam insulation sits inside of that tray. And then
So when you say the inner cover is damp in the ones without insulation, that's because you have an inner cover underneath a lid, whereas with the insulation, you have the lid above the insulation.
Yes, exactly. Yes,
so,
sir.
Yeah, so that's what I expect. If you have no insulation, the inner cover is going to get wet.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and if you have insulation, inner covers will not get wet. But that would happen independent of top ventilation.
Well, there was no top ventilation with that. Yeah.
Right. So my question to you is, what test have you done for that the only variable was top, was having a top ventilation or not?
Well, I think the bigger question was more around...
Listen to my question.
Okay.
If you're saying that you did an experiment...
No, I did no experiment.
Experiments are based upon... Well, you had an observation. You were comparing. You said this worked better than something else. That's an experiment.
Okay.
Okay, which means you had to control the variables. It sounds like you put on two variables at one time, top ventilation plus insulation.
No, completely different hive. So I had a couple colonies that it was my belief that they were completely saturated with condensation because the inner cover was really, really heavy. And I thought, wow, it's really wet and it's heavy and these bees died. I wonder if there was too much condensation that killed them. So in subsequent years with other colonies, I've then gone to this vented inner cover, which is really only vented in the spring and summer, because the insulation kind of closes it, going down to the very bottom.
So hang on a second.
Sure.
Wait. You've changed to a vented inner cover with insulation, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm saying you're adding two variables.
Well, no, because it's vented in the summertime, but you put insulation in there that completely closes it basically in the wintertime.
So there's no ventilation in the wintertime.
Yes, sir. Yeah, just whatever could sneak past the insulation kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Okay. I suggest that you clarify what you tell these papers then, because that was very unclear when you explained it to me.
I think I should have been more specific.
You had a question about top ventilation. And now you're saying, no, there was no top ventilation. But you said the question was about top ventilation, and you drew a conclusion. And now you're saying, no, there was no top ventilation. So I'm really confused by what you were saying.
Well, it's more that I have this, I named the piece is the Honey Run Apiary's vented inner cover is what they defined it as on their website. So I didn't know if you had heard of it.
You're telling me that there's no ventilation. So I would leave that word out of your sentences.
Well, at the entrance, is the entrance completely wide open? Do you use an entrance reducer with a 3/4 inch entrance? You know, trying to assume how much air are we letting in at the bottom to then negate or offset condensation with the heat.
Oh, wow. Okay.
By the hive.
So let me make a suggestion.
Okay.
When people talk about ventilation of beehive, they generally are thinking about top ventilation during the winter, adding a ventilation over the winter. Ventilation at the bottom makes almost no difference whether that opening is wide or not. That's not really ventilation. Bees are just fine at the bottom with a couple of little tiny holes. During the winter, they need almost no ventilation whatsoever at the bottom opening.
Yeah, I've done the 3/4 inch entrance. I've been wide open and everything in between. I haven't seen a lot at the bottom. I was curious, you know, if you had seen anything different and any other benefit. And I think you answered it very effectively with regard up top.
We're talking about bottom vent opening.
Yes. Okay. Now, up top, I like to go wide open in the summertime. I like that ventilation to go through in the summertime because that seems to work really well to reduce bearding and keep the overall airflow better. That's just my unofficial independent observation.
Okay. So you run colonies side by side with top or bottom and compare the bearding to them?
Say again?
You've run colonies side by side with some with top ventilation and no with top ventilation during the summer, and you looked at the bearding?
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely.
So the ones that have the top ventilation during the summer have less bearding than the ones that do not have top ventilation.
I would say like 50-70% less bearding. Yes.
Okay, great. That's the kind of observation that I'd be interested in. That's called data. That you have some evidence to try to draw a conclusion from.
Well, if that is of interest, I'm happy to put that experiment on for you and send you some data if it's something that no one else is
doing.
Yeah,
I'd be interested. You know, it's something that we can do. The first question I ask, though, is why does varying bother you?
Doesn't bother me a bit. My only concern would be if it's excessive and you know you're out of space and you're running the risk of absconding. But I mean, in general, I don't care about bearding at all.
Yeah, because that's a natural behavior for bees.
Yeah, I just figure if they're outside, give them a little more air, a little more ventilation, make them a little bit less congested.
I'd want to see more because now you're talking about the bees regulate humidity inside the hive. So that's an interesting question to me. I have not run that experiment yet. And I want to also take a look and see how that affects the inner humidity and the brood patterns if you do that. Because you're in a humid summer, so I'm in a totally different area, and a very dry summer, so it's very, very different here. It's very difficult for bees to cool colonies in hot weather in a humid climate. Very, very difficult. Same with humans. So with climate change, we're getting warmer and warmer summers in your climate. That may be more and more important. So I am open to that. I would love to hear research findings.
Okay.
And anytime you want to run an experiment, run your protocol by me before you start.
Okay.
So you don't waste time.
Well,
and I'm happy to check out. And I'm pretty much open to anybody listening on that. I have lots of students and beekeepers and some researchers running protocols by me prior to, hey, send me a bunch of time. Have you seen any problem with my protocol? And so I'm always happy to. Actually, I'm working on one this morning with a researcher.
No, I appreciate that because, you know, most of my experience, like I said, is hands-on beekeeping in the yard, and I haven't spent time, you know, in the lab and doing the scientific documentation of things. And I think back to the old science class as well. You form a hypothesis, and then you run through, and you have your control pieces, and then you have a theory, or you have to confirm your hypothesis. And, you know, so, yeah, it's been a while for me, so I certainly appreciate the offer to put a second set of eyes on things.
Yeah. So when the red flag to me is people say, oh, this seems to work. that's a red flag for me. I mean, turn off the volume.
I picked the wrong guy to say seems to, huh?
You talked to the wrong guy to say that to. Exactly.
Well, Randy, I know you've got a lot going on today, and I sincerely appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, you bet. Anytime.
Chat with us today, and thank you for all the tremendous contributions that you are making, continuing to make, and have made in the past to the beekeeping community. And folks, it's scientificbeekeeping.com is where you can track Randy down. And Randy, if you ever have a information or something you need to get out to the community, you're always welcome to come back anytime and chat with us again. And hopefully we'll look forward to catching up with you maybe at a show somewhere or our paths will cross somewhere.
Yep. You're free to call me again.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Okay. Right. Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Randy Oliver. And man, he was giving it to me there, wasn't he? I tell you what. No, but that was fun. And I appreciate him kind of challenging me on things because the reality is what I've done, you know, with this so far has not been scientific in nature. It's been like, well, this is what I did and it seemed to work. But again, when you're talking to a scientist, you got to be careful using the word seems. So anyway, I hope that you guys enjoyed the discussion with Randy. I had probably like three or four more questions for him, but nothing earth shattering. I think we covered most of the important things. And, you know, if you guys would like to kind of learn more about what he's doing, again, go to scientificbeekeeping.com. And you can check out on the National Honey Show, I think is the YouTube channel. They've got links to some of his videos. Reading the Comb, that's a great video to check out. And I'm doing beekeeping tip of the day. I think today was day 10 or 11, something like that. So we've got one released every day for the month of September. And feel free to check us out on YouTube if you want to see those tips of the day. I've also got the 5 reasons why you shouldn't become a beekeeper and a few other videos that you just might enjoy. And I've got another interview coming up this Friday, which we'll talk to you some more about that. We'll have that one released in about 12 or 13 days, something like that. Outside of that, take care, be kind to one another, and remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.